This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is sponsored by ChristianAudio.com. Listeners of the Gospel Coalition podcast can get 50% off of their audiobook or audio Bible purchases from Christian Audio for a limited time. Browse ChristianAudio.com and use discount code TGC50 at checkout before this offer ends on September 30th, 2016. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. Lauren Chandler was just 17 years old when she met her future husband, Matt, who was older by 6 years. She was engaged at 18 and married at 19 when he was 25. Now they've been married for 17 years and have 3 kids, the oldest of whom just became a teenager. The dating worries and anxieties they've long since left behind in their own relationship have now hit home for them as parents. While much has changed in their lives in the dating scene for Christians in the last 20 years, much more about human relationships remains the same. Many who don't want to be single are still single. Dating is usually confusing, potentially hurtful, and seemingly necessary. Marriage and childbirth may be delayed, but the nuclear family remains a goal for most young adults. How, then, can Christians walk this path with integrity, holiness, and discernment? Matt and Lauren Chandler will be leading a Mingling of Souls dating conference on November 11th at Central Baptist Church near Texas A&M University in College Station. You can join them in person or watch a simulcast on your own or with a group. Use the code TGC to receive a discount when you register for the simulcast or event in person. Before then, you can pick up Matt's book, Mingling of Souls, God's Plan for Love, Marriage, Sex, and Redemption. Matt is the lead teaching pastor of the Village Church in Dallas, Texas. And now Matt and Lauren join me on the Gospel Coalition podcast to answer some tough questions on singleness and dating. Thank you, Matt and Lauren.
Hey, we're glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So, as I said, you two have been married for 17 years. I've been married to my wife, Lauren, for 13 years. Your oldest child is 13, and mine isn't even 2. So we're not speaking with much current experience on this subject, but we are each leaders in especially youthful churches, and I reached out to some single, dating, and newlywed friends for their help in forming these questions, so hopefully we'll hit the mark with the audience here. So, Matt, just to start off, can you imagine your daughter meeting her husband only 4 years from now?
Oh, my gosh, no. Absolutely not.
Do you think with marriage there are certain markers that you think have to be achieved, graduate from high school or graduate from college, or any in failing those official markers, is there something else that you'd look for if your daughter came back and said, I'm ready to get married, that you said, okay, I can tell that you're ready for this?
Yeah, you know, I think there is. I'm looking for my daughter's identity to be rooted in Christ, or at least have a real healthy sense of self and who she is, and then to have a realistic view of what this is. And then if I think back to my conversation with Lauren's dad when I was asking to marry her, you know, my understanding was that Lauren was still under the authority of her parents. She didn't have her own apartment. She didn't have, you know, her own career. Her parents were paying her bills. Her parents had her car note. Her parents were paying for school. She was very much a woman under authority. And so when I went and asked for her hand, her dad had a list of things that he wanted me to commit to before he would say yes. And so he said, her mom and I want her to finish school. And so, man, I committed to Johnny. She will stay in school and finish her degree. And then he had a couple of other things that he just asked. And so for me at that point, it wasn't really up to me. It was up to her dad on what the parameters were for his blessing to marry her at that age. And so if I'm looking at my own daughter, I'm looking at how she identifies herself. And Johnny had some visions and hopes for his daughter. And so he just transferred those to me. I would like her to be able to do this. I want her to finish this. And so we took all those and I said, I'll commit to every one of those. And that was super beneficial to just have him really be, we want you know, we've prayed for her around these things. We want her to finish this and to do this and do this. And then if I would have gone, yeah, I can't promise that, then again, who knows? But yeah, I'm looking for her identity, spiritual health in some sense. And then, I mean, I think who the guy is really going to matter to me. I mean, you know, I've spent every day of that little girl's life protecting, providing, training, speaking into, cuddling with, crying with, praying with. And this guy is asking to take my spot. Now, I get it. It's not my, it's only my spot to give to another. Like, I totally get that. I'm training Audrey in a real sense to not need me the way she needs me now. And that's going to be another man's role. But if it's a guy that's incompetent and can't do that, or isn't on the trajectory to be able to do that, then man, that's just going to be significantly more difficult to say yes to or to support. But again, I'm in that place where it's hard for me at 13 to see who she is now, to watch how she's seen the world, to think she's going to bring home a bum.
Exactly. So now, Lauren, let me shoot forward to usually the other end of the age spectrum, especially as it relates to women and marriage. There are some single women who feel the need, or at least feel the temptation, to hold themselves back, either in terms of spiritual maturity or career success, because they don't want to intimidate single men and potentially chase off suitors. So how would you counsel a woman who feels this tension?
First of all, I can understand where she might be coming from, where it's, you know, I think as women, we can struggle with being too much or not enough. And this might be one of those on the too much end of the spectrum where you feel like, okay, I'm too much, you know, to attract a man. I'm too much for him to consider me to be his wife. And, but I would say to her that God didn't make a mistake in making her, in making you, and that he put these gifts, these talents and desires in you. And I think about Psalm 37:4, it says, delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. And I was just reading through that recently and read just kind of a commentary on it, where that Hebrew word that's translated delight there does mean to enjoy, but it also can mean to be soft or pliable. And so kind of this idea of being soft to the Lord, to be, you know, to look for him, to listen for him, to be molded by his word, that if we are soft to the Lord and pliable to the Lord, that he will give us the desires of our hearts. And, you know, I hear that verse used a lot with single women, you know, like, okay, Lord, you know, my desire is for a husband. And I think probably you're right. Your desire probably is for a husband, but the Lord only knows our heart's desires, like on the deepest level. And so I think to a single woman who is growing in spiritual maturity, who is advancing in her career or her ministry pursuits, that for her to keep doing that and being soft to the Lord and trusting him with her heart's desire, because maybe it is a husband, but maybe she's going to find some kind of satisfaction and contentment in her career or in ministry or whatever the Lord kind of has for her. And maybe it is a husband, but just coming to that place of not being ashamed of how God's made her, trusting him with her, you know, with her desires, and watching and waiting for him to fulfill those. And so that's what I would tell a woman. Keep using and investing your gifts and your talents. Remain soft to the Lord and trust that as you continue to grow in spiritual maturity in your career and ministry, that he will indeed give you your heart's desire.
Do you ever see that situation play out, Matt, with women holding themselves back?
There's no question. It's one of the more heartbreaking things that you watch and see, specifically in Christian dating, and especially in kind of, I don't know how to speak about this, the tribe or the stream that we would identify with, where it, somewhere, and I don't know how it happened, like somewhere in complementarian thought, like women are to just not be smarter, or to have like, insight, deep insight into things beyond their man. And I personally find that to be an absurd idea. I certainly think it's an absurd idea if you're just being really honest about the scriptures and what the scriptures have to say, that I'm very much in a partnership with Lauren, and really that I flourish as Lauren flourishes and Lauren flourishes as I flourish. Mm-hmm. And so Lauren has some really specific gifts and insights that I am horrifically weak at. And man, God loved me enough to give me a partner in ministry that can help me see those things and speak life into me, and in a very real way, be a hard edge. Not just a soft edge, but a hard edge that sharpens my edges. And so although Lauren would be just as godly and generous and sweet and submissive and as any woman I've been around, she's unbelievably brilliant and godly and a good leader, and for her to feel like she can't utilize those gifts in the kingdom because I'm an idiot, like that would be such a shame and such a knock on God's gift to his people in the gifts that he sowed into Lauren or Jen Wilkin or Lori Wilbert. I mean, I can just go on and on. Colleen Searcy, these just really tremendous, gifted, brilliant women of God at our church. So it's a sad thing when a woman doesn't want to be lonely, so plays the fool and doesn't develop her gifts. She robs herself. She robs the church. Then I think she dishonors God.
Well, it sounds like then really it's a message for the men in what they should be looking for and what they should be aspiring to find in a wife, which I think would really help the situation of help women to then grow and to flourish as God intends. But Matt, there may be any number of different factors as to why men might not be looking for the right things in women. And I wonder, Matt, how much of a factor do you think is pornography in men choosing to delay marriage?
Yeah, I certainly think it's a factor in how they think about women, how they consider women, and then ultimately I think that leads to how they view marriage altogether. And so pornography is just a really insidious, kind of brain-twisting, soul-shriveling reality. It's a social experiment playing out on us that I think that people have not connected the dots with the rise of pornography and the rise of rape and the rise of molestation, and that sociologists are unwilling to just boldly make this connection. It's a tragedy. And so pornography misshapes everything about how a man views and sees a woman. She becomes an object, something to be consumed rather than something to be treasured. And the irony is they short-circuit the beauty of the relationship with the woman in God's design and short-circuits their ability to actually enjoy sex as a good gift of common grace. And so really, in their lustfulness, they rob themselves from the very thing their heart is hungry for. So I don't know if it delays marriage, but it certainly has broken hundreds and hundreds of marriages as women are consumed and not valued.
We want the gospel to be at the heart of Christian marriage, but I'm wondering, what does it look like, especially within the context of the way that online dating has brought to the fore this discussion of compatibility and of sort of sizing one another up? So, I mean, isn't that basically what's happening in all dating? You're sizing somebody else up. You're trying to be found worthy. And I'm wondering, is it possible to be realistic about evaluating somebody, you know, a potential marriage partner's strengths and weaknesses without sidelining the gospel of grace?
Yeah, I think there is a way to do it. I think it is a little tricky, but I think even in the scriptures, you're going to see, specifically if you start to look at the song, you start looking at some things that are either red flags or yellow flags, some things that are certainly deal killers. And so as we watch the relationship evolve in the song, you've got kind of these things happening. They've got godly counsel that approves and says, we can see this. This is looking good. You've got a guy there showing initiative, pursuing her heart. She's not wondering what's going on. You've got a relationship that's safe and pure. And so you've got these little markers in the relationship early on that can serve as a yellow or red flag. If we put marriage in the context of the scriptures and see it as a partnership of gospel ministry and a picture of God's reconciliation of man and Christ, where Christ and his bride, the church, if we see it in that light, then all of a sudden my evaluation is gospel driven and not not necessarily driven by the world's compatibility. So like here would be an example. One of the things I learned about Lauren very early on, in fact, we used to fight a lot about it because of my insecurity, but Lauren is, she's independent enough to let me do all that God has called me to do, but she's dependent enough to kind of want me around when I'm around. And so like that independence early on, like I hated that she was in, I just wanted her to want me all the time and need me around all the time. But really that independence here all these years later, I look at that. It's just one of my favorite things about the wife that God has given me, that she loves it when I'm around, but lets me run, like the Lord wants me to run, I believe. And so I'm able to honor her and love her and serve her, and at the same time work long days and work long weeks, and she's just that. That's the kind of compatibility. I'm like, can I serve the Lord in gladness alongside of this woman? Now becomes the compatibility I'm looking for. Not do I like how she chews her food, or does, because she certainly would not marry me if that was the compatibility that she was looking for. And so I think it's the type of compatibility that begins to change when the gospel bears its weight on how we date.
Let me follow up with you, Lauren, on a couple other issues then that I hear often from single women. What would you say to the Christian woman who has never received attention from men and may therefore doubt her worth before God?
You know what? I'm reading a book right now where she's a single Christian woman. Love her heart. And, you know, she talks about kind of the early memory she has of just kind of that physical appearance, and that there was a way that she should have looked and a way that she looks now that's like right and wrong. So how she should look is the right, and how she looks now is wrong. And that stuck with her. It was a label where she's like, who I am and how I look is wrong, and it's not attractive to men, and that's not even what women would want to look like, and how that shame has marked her, and my heart broke and for her, because it robbed her of this joy of just being who she was and how God made her, and she was more than what she was on the outside, but she was who she was on the inside, and who she was on the outside wasn't unimportant. But it also wasn't defining. And so, you know, to the Christian woman who's never received attention from men, I think it's a blessing and a curse. I think it's a blessing in that you don't necessarily feel like, I think as you grow, if a woman has gotten attention from men and kind of defines herself that way, it makes it really hard to grow old as a woman, because you think, I'm walking in a room and men aren't turning their heads. Who am I now? You know, am I worth something? Am I attractive? Where's my identity? So kind of the flip side of being the quote unquote pretty girl is that you learn to define yourself by how men react to you. And so I think part of the blessing of not maybe being someone who walks into the room and all the heads turn is that you don't define yourself in that way by that. And so you are forced to kind of look a little bit more into, you know what, the fact that I don't turn heads, there's something more there. And so, and you can just still define yourself by that, even if you don't turn heads, where you define yourself as, okay, I'm not the pretty girl, or I'm not this, but letting the Lord be your definition and trusting, kind of going back to what I said, that Psalm 37:4 of, you know, delighting yourself in the Lord and being soft to him and knowing that he has made you exactly how you should be, and not being ashamed of your body and not being ashamed of what's on the outside, but he has made something beautiful.
Let me ask a practical situation here. So how does a woman, or should a woman, indicate to a man her interest in him. We know men usually initiate. So how can women handle their own romantic desire, Lauren, without seeming too forward or desperate?
You know, I don't think it's, you know, yes, men are the initiators, and women, we more respond, and that's what we want. We want to be pursued. We want men to initiate, you know, a relationship with us, and then we get to respond to that. So in an ideal world, there's a man that comes and, you know, sweeps you off your feet, and you're like, yes, and but we don't live in an ideal world, and sometimes men can be a little blind, and they can be a little... you know, not pick up on some things. And so I think for a woman, if there is a man that you are interested in, that you're like, you know what, I love how he loves God. I love how he loves people. He is someone like him is who I want to marry. Then I think I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, going to group things and he's there and, you know, finding yourselves maybe talking to each other a little bit more than you're talking with everyone else. I think there's some subtle ways to show a man, look, I'm interested.
Hey, dummy.
I like being with you. I like having, you know, spending time with you. And I don't, you know who I think of? And I don't know, it's not necessarily prescriptive or whatever, but I think about Ruth kind of laying it out for Boaz, saying, hey, I would love for you to kind of to be my covering, where she does something a little bit scandalous to say, I'm interested. And, you know, I don't think a woman should go, you know, creep into a guy's room and lay at his feet. But I do think there's some subtle ways of just saying, hey, I'm interested. I don't think you should stalk a man. I don't think you should, you know, show up at his house at random hours of the night. But I think there's a way where you can subtly just say, hey, I'm interested. Finding those time, taking advantage of times together where you're in a group and you kind of find yourselves talking, or maybe you have an opportunity where as a woman, you're invited to something, you can bring a date and saying, hey, I have this thing. Would you want to come with me? And just very casually putting it out there and then seeing where it goes. I don't think that is the woman leading or initiating. I think you're using what you've got and being gentle about it and subtle. And then hopefully the guy will pick up on it some way. And I don't know, maybe you have married friends who you can just bounce some of this off of, who know you and the guy and know the situation, and you can say, hey, what do you think about this? Is this a little bit too forward? Is this going to kind of step on his toes? And because you definitely don't want to make the guy feel like not the man in the relationship. You want him to want to pursue you. And so I think it's important too to have people in your life, married people, where you can ask the man and the woman, hey, what do you think? Is this too much? Is it not, you know, am I being wise and kind of putting this out here with this guy?
So I always think of, I probably would have answered this question differently 10 years ago, but Lauren and I had dinner with a pastor and his wife in Orange County several years ago. And, you know, we were getting to know him, and I love him. And so I'm not using any names in the story because it's their story, but we're like, you know, with that first dinner, you're like, okay, so how'd you guys meet? And his wife, they'd been married many years, like literally just said, hey, we should date. And then they started dating. And then about 2 years later, he's like, hey, I think we should break up. And she said, yeah, no, you're not breaking up with me. And then they ended up getting married and have been really happily married and really successful in ministry. Just love the Lord deeply. Have planted churches all over the United States. We got one in LA, one in Boston, it was a funny moment for me to hear this. Like, she just literally said, hey, we should date. And then he tried to break up with her. He's like, yeah, no, I'm not letting you break up with me. And so, I mean, that's certainly not an ideal situation, but it's one that, I mean, the Lord worked in and honored. And yeah. Anyway.
Well, let me extrapolate that from these individual issues to a church-wide issue. And especially, Matt, your role as a pastor in this large church with many singles, many young people overall. What does a thriving culture for singles look like in a church. I think we probably have a better sense of what it shouldn't look like in a church. So what positively should a thriving culture for singles look like in a church?
So let me start with this. I think if you ask the singles at the Village Church, they probably wouldn't think we had a thriving ministry to or culture for singles. And so I want to start by that. We have gotten, and in fact, just recently got a great proposal from a group of singles at the church just asking for some specific things. And so one of the things that I started adjusting, even in my preaching last year, was that I tend to think as a married man in a church primarily made up of married people or people who want to be married. And so my illustrations, my almost everything is tied to a married person's life. And so really via the encouragement of a couple of singles that we're friends with, starting with, we did a family discipleship series earlier this year. And that was the first time I worked really hard to make sure as I was communicating that singles felt like they had a part to play in that, and that they had been invited into that, and what their role was concerning that in the life of the body. And so I think one of the ways that it looks is that you're acknowledging and that you've got illustrations and you've got things directed towards singles, and you're not just constantly using marriage or sports as the analogy.
Well, related to that then, Matt, this would affect not only your illustrations, but essentially your overall theological perspective and your leadership in many ways. Do you think there are ways that singles cannot be sanctified that only married people can be?
No, I wouldn't say that. God has called his people, his children, into community with one another. And deep community always reveals aspects of our heart that we can't see for our blind spots. So being married to Lauren was that for me, but for many singles, being in their home group or having deep friendships with one another is the thing that reveals selfishness, reveals areas of the heart where there's idolatry that they couldn't see for themselves. And so iron sharpening iron, so one man sharpens another, that's a violent process. It's not a verse that belongs on a coffee cup. It's describing a really painful reality of what it's like to be in community with other believers. And so, no, I don't think there are some things available to married couples that aren't available to singles. I mean, I was married as a junior in college, and so I didn't live in that space, and so I want to be real careful there. Mm-hmm. The thing I have noticed, though, is that what the Lord has rended out of my relationship with Lauren, I've watched him rend in the heart of our singles in their home groups and in their deep friendships.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges there is that we confuse the experiential with the normative. My wife, Lauren, and I, we grew up together in the Lord. So I think it's easy, though, to assume then that must be the case for everyone else, when in our minds we know that can't be true, because we worship a Savior who was not married, and we read a lot about sanctification from a man, Paul, also wasn't married. So
I was going to say, if you want to kind of start to walk through John the Baptist, Paul, and Jesus as somehow being incomplete in regards to their sanctification, I'll let somebody else take that ball and run with it. I'm not touching it.
No, exactly. And I think that's a challenge there. And you also, I mean, I tend to look back on human history, and sometimes young people or people who are worried about young men in particular will ask me, okay, what am I supposed to do to try to help this young man mature? One of the difficulties is, historically speaking, it's not like young men were somehow different at other times. It's that they didn't really have any options. You know, they were forced to fight for themselves to be able to survive in terms of work. They were essentially married and had kids at younger ages, or they were sent off to war. Well, I mean, those factors are going to grow you up. They're not necessarily all going to be positive for you if you're not, you know, driven by the Spirit, you're not pursuing holiness, but they are going to grow you up. And if none of those things is present in your life, well, there may not be the same violent action that you're talking about there that forces some things upon you. So you might have to be a little bit more deliberate relationally in singleness or things like that. But again, you look back on those examples from Scripture, and it's very clear. It's not a married single thing. This is about relationships, about intentionality, about pursuing the Lord, and about being deliberate about holiness, as opposed to simply falling into whatever the world is telling us ought to be the case, especially these days. Well, let me ask you, Lauren, a couple questions related to the sensitive area of sex in relationships. And I'm wondering, in a dating relationship, at what point would you regard it as appropriate for a Christian to reveal past sexual sin that might affect a future marriage relationship? Probably not the first date,
No. But
it's also not something that should wait until after engagement, I'm guessing.
Right. I mean, I think it's kind of a sliding scale, so to speak, where definitely not the first date or even the kind of getting to know you, becoming friends, and then becoming more. You can sense when, hey, this is someone that I could see myself spending the rest of my life with, and that's mutual. And you are talking about looking at rings and looking at that sort of thing to say, hey, before we move into this, before we start looking at rings and considering dates and all that, there's some things I need to just share with you. And so that's when I think, when you're starting to talk about marriage and before that engagement ring is on the finger, coming to that place of this is where I've been, this is my past. And I would hope that you, because you love one another, that you have gotten to know one another, that no matter what you would say to that person, that there would be grace and maybe there'd be an adjustment of maybe the time frame for marriage, or there'd be some kind of, okay, considering that's your background or that's what happened to you or whatever, fill in the blank, let's go through either some kind of counseling or something together. But I would hope at that point that it wouldn't be a, okay, this is too much for me, but maybe it would be a, okay, let's slow things down. Let's kind of go, let's seek some counsel together and how, you know, your past, my past, it might affect our potential marriage.
Yeah, it makes sense. And related to that, I was talking not long ago with a dating couple about to get married, and they mentioned that right before, like in their second date, they started talking about Christian marriage, and he confessed a lot of his sexual sin. And in a lot of other different circumstances, I could imagine that not being a good idea. And yet in this case, it was actually a sign of deep maturity on their part. Like there was an immediate compatibility, an immediate desire. Yeah. They came together on that gospel compatibility that you guys talked about a little while ago. And immediately it's like, look, you need to know this. Now God has redeemed me from this past, but you need to know this about me so that you can make a decision about whether you want to walk with me forward in this. And so, again, it's not something that I would recommend, but in their case, I was absolutely blown away with their maturity, and it's really paid off in a healthy relationship going forward. So now this is a little bit of a different question than Lauren, but aside from the obvious example of sex, is it possible for a dating couple to be too close to each other before they marry?
You know, I think so, and not too close in a positive way, but too close in a negative way, where you kind of border on, I think psychologists called an enmeshment, where you just don't really know, you know. Once you get married, yes, you are becoming one, but you still have a sense of, I'm still Lauren, and, you know, Matt's still Matt, and then we are one, but we don't, like, my happiness is not built on Matt. My identity is not completely built on Matt. Am I Matt's wife? Yes, but I'm the Lord's. I'm also Matt's sister in Christ. And so I think there are some things in dating or even engagement where it becomes enmeshed, where your happiness is wrapped up in your who you're dating or your identity is wrapped up in them. And I would say that I bought into this when we were dating and even early in our marriage. And so I can say that it's not a deal killer. I think the Lord can work in all kinds of relationships, but ideally, how that affected me was, you know, I would know I'm okay if Matt was happy with me, if I was being a good wife or being a good girlfriend, or, you know, he talked earlier in our, earlier about, you know, he wanted me to be dependent on him enough that I like, where is he, you know, longing for him all the time. And that's not necessarily healthy. And so I had some unhealthy expectations of, okay, my happiness is wrapped up in Matt being pleased with me and him feeling respected by me and him having a good day. And so that's a way that I think is too close for even in marriage, honestly. You know, I've heard it say, you know, don't pray together too much, or, you know, those sort of things. Don't talk about the Lord too much. And I would say, sure, don't pray together in your boyfriend's apartment late at night. I don't think that's going to be good. But by all means, pray together and talk about the Lord at the coffee shop, you know, at 6 o'clock in the evening or something like that. So I think that matters where you are. And so I don't think you can get too close spiritually. But I do think you can become too close emotionally in some ways.
Well, Matt, let me end it with this question. It's not likely that any couple is going to agree on every point of theology, especially if they meet older, when they've formed a lot of their independent beliefs on these issues. But we do all draw the line somewhere when it comes to, you know, dating, compatibility, yeah, and ultimately with marriage. So, what kind of theological differences should make a couple question whether they are compatible for marriage?
Yeah, I think that question's so complex. Because I think if you're already formed, you'll have some doctrines that you're going to hold with a looser grip than others. And so, whereas one person might say, you know, baptism for me, you know, this is an area I can see, okay, you're covenantal. Okay, I understand where you're, I understand that. Okay, I got that. I'd be willing, as we work through this, to kind of loosen up my grip on this one. And I know somewhere right now, Mark Dever is shuddering, but, and so then I would go, oh, well, okay. So I wouldn't want to say this and this, you know, I'm going to say atonement. I think it's a huge one. I mean, if you disagree on the nature of the atoning work of Christ, I think you're in a lot of trouble. The very basis of what makes justification occur. I mean, if you think about how misshapen things get if your view of atonement is differing. So I think atonement's going to be the deal killer. And then outside of that, I think, man, I've just met people that on even secondhand issues, their grip is so tight that it would be incompatible. So I don't think it's as simple as a list of things that should. I would be bold enough to say atonement is definitely one. But I've met people that have flexed on the baptism question. I've met people who have flexed on cessationism and continuation. I want to be real careful not to have a list that people, even despite my little, hey, there shouldn't be one, that from me are going to put more weight into my words than I would want there to be. So I think there's a level of conscience involved. There's a level of conviction involved. But outside of the atonement, I'd be real careful here not to just make a big list of what you should and shouldn't have as a deal killer.
Let me try to do a case study, and we'll try to see how that would work, because I'm learning as we go here. So let's say there's a woman in your congregation who has been in your church for a while. She's a member, maybe even helping to lead some kind of ministry or something like that. She's single. She meets a guy who is a member at Park City's Prez.
All right.
And
love Park City's.
Right, exactly. So in that case, it sounds like you wouldn't really necessarily have a problem if she said, I'm dating this guy at Park City's Prez, and with the implication that if we get married, we're probably going to go to his church and I'm going to become a Presbyterian. That sounds like for you, that wouldn't be much of an issue.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm going to all of a sudden be real panicked for her soul or get to really worry about what's going to befall her. In fact, you know, because it's funny that you would use Park City's No Mark, love what they're doing down there. A lot of jokes about getting babies wet. And and so, no, I would not have, I would not be nervous. I certainly would not counsel her to not, you know, to get out of that relationship. And sister, listen to me. I love you. There's just a doctrinal error here that is going to make the rest of your life a battlefield. And so, no, yeah, to use that as a case study, I mean, I would just encourage her, does he love the Lord? Does he love you? Is he serious about the Word of God? But part of that is I understand covenantal theology, and so I get it. I mean, I'm in Together for the Gospel. I mean, I've got great friends who are wrong on this issue, and so it's a... So no, that wouldn't be a deal killer for me at all.
But if there's now, if there's a say liberal mainline church that absolutely rejects penal substitutionary atonement, they teach a basic gospel of Jesus loves you, you ought to be loving to other people. Then you're sitting down with her or him and
I would
saying,
totally get in that space.
Got it.
I would totally get in that space, talk about the nature of what love is, even talk about what that would be, what that picture means for her marriage. So if there's just love and love is never angry and love never has any wrath and love never has anything that needs to be repented of, then what's the picture of your marriage? Like, what's Paul talking about then in Ephesians 5? And so, yeah, I would definitely have a conversation around that where I would just plead with her, sister, you're about to put not just yourself, but your children and the rest of your life in a space that I think might only not just be unhealthy, but could be damning.
Well, my guests on the Gospel Coalition podcast have been Matt and Lauren Chandler. I encourage you to check out their Mingling of Souls dating conference to hear more along the lines of what we've been discussing here today. It's November 11th at Central Baptist Church near Texas A&M University in College Station. Use the code TGC to get a discount when you register for the simulcast or event in person. Again, also, you can check out Matt's book, Mingling of Souls, God's Plan for Love, Marriage, Sex, and Redemption. Matt and Lauren, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Colin.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.